continues, with Stuart finally coming face to face with Ellie's brothers, who've not forgiven him for the wrong he committed 5 years earlier.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel?
Aye, but they still compete. I'm not saying the teams don't compete. I'm simply seeking to contrast the cutthroat, evolutionary, highly competitive world of the European and particularly the English league system with the moribund, non-relegatory, survival-guaranteed world of US-American so-called football. Ferg puts down his cards and slides a fiver into the centre of the table. Talking of which, raise your five. You call that big money? No, just money. Okay, see you then. Nines and fours, jack high, you bluffing bastard, Felpe. Sunday, around noon. Traditional time for the weekly poker game at Lee Bickwood's. Lee's family ran the town's main hardware store for over a century until Homebase and B&Q moved into their respective retail estates on the outskirts of town. Now, most of the family lives in Marbella and Lee has a couple of gift and gizmo shops here and in Aberdeen. Felpe prefers to be known as Ryan these days, but we still think of him as Felpe. And besides, calling him Ryan would confuse things, given that Felpe works for Mike Mack, who has a son called Ryan. He looks bulkily fit and well-fed these days, brown hair slicked back. He wears a blue fleece over a pink shirt, jeans, but new ones. The rest of us are in sweats, tees and old jeans, trainers all round. Even Ferg has dressed down specifically for the occasion. This is so much like the old days. And again, I have mixed feelings. In some ways, it's good and comfortable to be fitting straight back in like I've never been away. But on the other hand, I'm getting this constrictive feeling as well. After a long 2 minutes of deliberation, Felpe goes a minimum pound. This leads to progress. On a majority vote round the table, Lee pulls out his Android phone and announces a 1 minute maximum thinking time limit. He leaves the phone on the table with the stopwatch function ready. "Any jumpers this week, Ezzy?" Lee asks. Ezzy nods. "Just the one, a female, but no a fatality." "That the lassie on Wednesday night?" "Aye, one of the McGurk girls, Chantal, youngest one, I think." "You treat her?" Lee asks Jim.
"Been on casualty all week," Jim says, with a nod.
"Amazing how many people jump before the water and hit the grun," Ezzy says, inspecting the interior of his wallet. "Even in daylight. At night, you'd understand."
Ryan Mack arrives, nods at me with a sort of wary politeness. I like the wary more than the politeness, and sits in. Ellie's ex, though I'll never be able to think of him that way. Ezzy had three kings, and deflates when he sees my hand. I suspect that's the last of his money. His wallet looks anorexic, and working in the bridge control room can't pay that well. I look him in the eyes, nod at the pile of money bracketed by my arms and say quietly, "Ezzy, this is all yours if you can tell me a bit more about some of that CCTV stuff." Ezzy looks alarmed.
"I can't sell you any of it."
"Any footage ever disappeared, Ezzy?"
"Can't really say, Stu."
"What if somebody wanted to see the time Callum Murston took a dive?" Now, Ezzy looks positively frightened.
"Think that was all wiped?"
"Wiped?
Polis, they said to. Didn't want it falling into the wrong hands."
"Really?" I ask. "The wrong hands? What does that mean, the press?"
"Aye," Ezzy says. "Like, if somebody put it on YouTube or something, Mr. M might get upset and things could kick off, Ken. I was on holiday at the time, Stu, that's all I know, honest."
Everything turned around. Packing up, checking up, sorry.
Later, Ryan and I are sitting back on the couch together while the others play or observe Muddy Funster 2 in all its beta version glory. "Listen, Ryan," I say quietly, because I haven't actually said this yet and I'm probably supposed to, whether I really feel it or not, and in the end he seems like a decent enough guy. "Ah,
I'm sorry about you and Ellie. Sorry it didn't work out.
Ryan shrugs, drinks, doesn't look at me. And I'm sorry about you and my sister.
I breathe out in a sort of soundless whistle. All breath, no note.
Saw Angelica yesterday, for whatever it's worth, Ryan. I think we're okay, Jell and me.
Yeah, good for you.
Ryan says with a small sneer, sighing and studying the top of the bud bottle.
But you really messed up a lot of people, you two.
Like I say, Ryan, I'm sorry.
Ryan shrugs again. Ah, well. If you see Ellie, tell her I said hello.
I don't know that I will, though, not to speak to. He gives a small, bitten-off laugh.
You just threw her away, he says, wagging his finger at me. That was... idiotic, Stuart.
He taps himself on the chest.
I just...
Ryan is sort of staring into the middle distance and can't decide what he just...
I just... wasn't up to keeping her, I guess.
He concludes and sounds sad, as though this has just occurred to him and it's a terrible truth. He coughs, pulls himself up straighter.
We were going to have a kid. Did you know that?
I think he's going to start crying. Who knows what might have been different for Ryan if the child had been born. He and Ellie might still be together, one happy family. He might still have her, have the sort of life I guess he wanted, or that Ellie wanted, and he was happy, grateful to be part of. Who knows? When I leave, maybe half an hour later, it's just gone 4. I stick my earbuds in and put the iPhone's tunes on shuffle. That means when somebody comes up behind you, you get no audible warning at all. And so they can grab your arm out of your jacket pocket, push it so far up your back you have to go on tiptoes because otherwise it feels like the bone's going to break, and the two of them can bundle you into the back of a suddenly appeared transit van. I'm face down on a grubby floor, dimly lit, staring at white-painted metal ridges scuffed to thin rust.
Comfy there, Stewie?
Murdo Murston asks. Murdo hasn't changed much. A little heavier, maybe.
Aye, comfy,
Norrie Murston says, and I'm tapped hard on the side of my head with something solid. I look round again to see the business end of a baseball bat just retreating. Norrie's holding it one-handed, smiling.
Guys, come on, I say. There shouldn't be a problem here. I'm back to pay my respects to your granddad Joe, that's all.
Murdo looks at me.
See tomorrow. At the funeral at the hotel afterwards.
What, Murdo?
Don't want you talking to her. Just leave her alone, right? Grandpa said he wanted you at the funeral. Who knows why, but he said it, so fair enough. You get to go. But you just leave Ellie alone.
Jeez, Murdo, she's her own woman. What if she comes up to me?
Then you'd better walk away.
The van has felt like it's been going up a straight, shallow slope for a while now. I can hear the sounds of other traffic. Then there's pressure against my back as the van brakes smoothly and we slow to what feels like walking speed.
The bridge. We're on the road bridge.
Norrie opens the rear doors and there's a rush of traffic noise.
Come and take a wee look, Murdo says.
Out of the van I can see the crisscrossing members of the girder work under the road surface. They aren't going to throw me down there, are they?
You tear the tape off their mouths, Murdo says. They think they'll get to scream or shout. But you just do this.
His right fist comes whipping round and punches me in the belly. I'm not ready for it, and it sends the breath whistling out of me as I double up, folding around the ball of pain in my guts.
Or, Norrie says brightly like he's just remembered, you can just whap them over the back of the head.
I'm bundled back in the van. They throw me out in the southern viewing area car park. Just before they kick open the doors, Murdo says,
you won't forget what we said about Ellie, eh?
And punches me hard in the balls. So it's a good 10 minutes before I care about anything besides the astounding, sickening, writhing gouts of pain heaving out of my groin and wrapping themselves round my guts and brain. I waddle to and down the steps and then along the underpass beneath the carriageway to the sound of trucks pounding above my head. I should get back to Mum and Dad's and then just go home to London now, today, without waiting for tomorrow and the funeral or the day after and my booked flight. I don't think I want to tell anybody what just happened. I'm ashamed I was so easily huckled into the van.
The Murstons and Mike Mack's people aren't above the law. The cops just turn a blind eye where it's felt that the two families are effectively doing police business, keeping the tune running smoothly. I was in the clubhouse of Olness Golf Club at the invitation of Mike McAvett, though apparently entirely with the blessing, and indeed probably at the instigation, of Donald Murston. In a little over a week, I'd be a married man. It was slightly unreal. That first night by the fire with Ellie seemed a very long time ago. I'd already had what had felt like a semi-formal meeting with Don up at the house. We were well past the "what are your intentions, young man" stage. I was marrying his eldest daughter. The wedding was pretty much fully organised and everything was arranged. At one point during our chat, Donald had asked me what I believed in. I was momentarily stumped. Did he mean religion-wise? "Well, I'm not really religious," I'd told Donald. We were sipping single malts, just the two of us, at the well-stocked bar in what he called his rumpus room, part of the extensive cellar area beneath Hill House. "I suppose I believe in truth."
"Truth? Have more whiskey, son," he said, reaching for the bottle.
I'd been summoned to the highly prestigious Olness Golf Club to meet people.
"Stuart, here you are,"
Mike Mack said, coming up, pumping my hand and leading me back towards the dining room. I was being introduced to the chief constable for the whole region, a brace of town councillors and local businessmen, and our MEP, Alan Lowndes. He and I got to talking over some more single malts, forming our own little subcommittee slightly apart from the rest of the guys.
"Quite a family you're marrying into."
"Really, just marrying the girl, to be honest, Alan."
"You haven't any reservations, have you?"
"Reservations? Well,
we all know the reputation Donald and the family have," Alan said in his best "we're all men of the world" tones. "The complicated relationship they have with the more obvious forces of law and order."
He inspected his glass.
"We all start out as idealists. I certainly did. I hope I still am, deep down. But idealism meets the real world sooner or later, and then you just have to
compromise?
I hope you're not one of those people who think that's a dirty word,"
Alan Lowndes, MEP, said with a forgiving, understanding expression.
"Marriage is about compromising. Families are about compromising. Being anything other than a hermit is about compromising. Parliamentary democracy certainly is. You either learn to compromise, or you resign yourself to shouting from the sidelines for the rest of your life. Or you arrange to become a dictator. There's always that, I suppose." He shrugged. "Not a great set of choices, really. But that's the price we pay for living together. And it's that or solitude. Then you really do become a wanker." "Another drink?"
Stone Mouth by Ian Banks was read by David Tennant. It's a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4, and the story continues all next week.